Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Thursday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today, partly sunny skies, looking for a high temperature around 103. Then for tonight, a slight chance for rain. Although, as we saw last night, that could depend what part of town you're in. Overnight lows expected to be around 80. Then for tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high of 99 degrees. Currently mostly sunny and 100. In a quick check of Valley traffic, an accident I-10 westbound at 27th Avenue is blocking the HOV lane. Also a collision in the median, I-10 westbound at 67th Avenue.
Big news from Arizona's Public Utilities Commission today. One of the commissioners has issued subpoenas for APS and its parent company, Pinnacle West, asking them to reveal all political spending in recent years, including on the 2014 races for the commission. This comes after months of controversy. KJZZ's Will Stone has been following all this. And Will, what's going on here?
Today, Mark, after months of waiting, Commissioner Bob Burns, who is one of the five commissioners on the Arizona's Corporation Commission, which regulates public utilities, filed subpoenas asking APS and its parent company to disclose all its political spending, and with a particular focus on the 2014 election cycle. Listeners might have heard that for almost 2 years now, there's been controversy over the fact that it's believed Arizona Public Service was behind about $3 million in dark money contributions to help support the campaigns of two current sitting commissioners during the 2014 election cycle. And for months and months, Bob Burns has been hammering at this issue, trying to get the company to reveal whether it did that, saying that this has cast a cloud over the commission. And every turn he's been thwarted. And today he said he took his constitutional right to exercise this power of subpoenaing these two companies.
Yeah, Will, as you say, Commissioner Burns has been dealing with this and trying to get to the bottom of this for quite a while now. Until today, he had resisted the issuing of subpoenas. Do we know about the timing? Why today?
I think that Bob Burns, and I just got off the phone with him, would say he'd exhausted every other option possible. More than a year ago, he asked that all the regulated utilities voluntarily refrain from spending money on commission races. A number of places responded and said, we'll do that. APS has rebuffed that. Then he asked APS, could you just voluntarily hand over, open your book, show us your spending, and let us know if you were behind this dark money? And they have refused to comply. So there's been going back and forth for a long time now. And then really what kind of, I think, brought it to this point was earlier this month, Commissioner Burns had hired an attorney who has a specialty in public utility commissions to conduct a broad investigation about undue influence on the commission. And the three other commissioners voted to suspend that contract, really calling it a fishing expedition, among other things. And here's what Bob Burns had to say about that.
Stopping this investigation is the desire of APS. The fact that the commission, some of the commission members seem to support that is, I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense to me.
That's Arizona Corporation Commissioner Bob Burns. Will Stone, what's the next step here? There's a timeline that's set out in these subpoenas, yes?
Yes. The CEO of APS and Pinnacle West, Don Brandt, now has some time to respond. But in about 20 days, he is ordered by the subpoenas to appear in front of the commission. Now, everyone has been saying all along that this thing is going to end up in court, and that will really decide what will happen. The attorney general has issued an opinion on this issue that Burns requested, and Burns's interpretation of that is that he, as a commissioner, has the authority not only to subpoena APS, but also its parent company, Pinnacle West, because that's a publicly traded company. So now we're just waiting to see the response from APS, what they say, and then whether this thing will head to court.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone on the news today that Corporation Commissioner Bob Burns has issued subpoenas for APS and its parent company, Pinnacle West. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Phil Latzman.
Scottsdale leaders have abandoned an anti-discrimination ordinance that proponents were hoping would make the city more inclusive to LGBT people.
The ordinance was designed to ban discrimination in Scottsdale based on sexual orientation and gender identity in employment, housing, and public accommodations. Cities like Phoenix, Tempe, Tucson, and Flagstaff already have such edicts in place.
But the effort was recently scrapped, and joining us now is Scottsdale Mayor Jim Lane. Mayor Lane, what happened?
Well, it went through a series of events, I suppose, some of which you might know the history of. An original ordinance was brought forward, and it was decided that we needed to have a work study to consider all points on it. And so from that, it was decided to move forward with some additional thoughts toward the protection of the religious community who felt maybe there were some issues with how they might be interpreted, I suppose, through the process that had been laid out, and then also the size of business that might be affected. So there were a number of things that, the majority of council felt would be important to bring forward in developing an ordinance that might respond to those concerns. And in that process, very simply, the LGBT community, and as represented by our council member, Virginia Cordy, decided that they felt that it wasn't going in the right direction and decided that they wanted it to be pulled. So that's what happened.
So according to Virginia Cordy, this law, this ordinance, I should say, would have excluded 91% of the city's businesses if written as proposed, because it would have excluded businesses with 15 or less employees. Was that something that you just couldn't move on, that other city council members and you couldn't move on?
Well, to be perfectly frank with it, myself and Councilman Phillips really are not and have not been in favor of the ordinance for a number of reasons, just on the general overall premise of whether or not it divides our community and whether or not it serves a purpose and it's responsive to a problem. And that's a matter of some judgment, I suppose, but that certainly it complicates things. And further to that, an overwhelming feeling that having each community have very separate and distinct differences, potentially in their ordinances, was going to be a sort of a convoluted and difficult thing for small businesses as well as everyone else, for that matter. So the idea that it should be handled on the state or federal level seemed to be more appropriate, and I think there is coming to be a little bit more of a consensus of opinion around that.
Given that places like Phoenix and Tempe, Tucson, Flagstaff, Sedona have these ordinances in place, does that put Scottsdale at any kind of competitive disadvantage when it comes to bidding for businesses or being attractive to tourists or potential residents?
You know, personally, I don't believe so, because I think Scottsdale has proven to be, through the years, the most welcoming community for all people, inclusive of the LGBT community. And that's really demonstrated by makeup on our council, but also in our community with the business owners and the people who live here and thrive here.
Scottsdale Mayor Jim Lane, thanks for your time.
Oh, certainly.
And on the line with us now is Angela Huey of One Community. It's an organization helping to link LGBT businesses and consumers in the Valley, and they've been pushing for this anti-discrimination ordinance in Scottsdale. So how disappointed are you that it seems to have fallen apart?
Well, we certainly would have loved to see Scottsdale, do the right thing and choose to celebrate and respect and protect everyone in the municipality. But while we're not there yet, I think that the public education campaign is so incredibly important. You know, the reality is 73% of Arizonans mistakenly believe that we have already updated these laws statewide. So every opportunity we get a chance to have this very important public dialogue about treating people who are LGBT the same as other Arizonans, we see it as a really good opportunity.
I spoke with the city councilwoman, Virginia Cordy, who had originally pushed this in Scottsdale as the right thing to do. And she was hopeful that state leaders might pick up on this and pass a statewide anti-discrimination law. How do you feel about that? And do you feel it's realistic that the state might step in and do it themselves?
You know, quite frankly, it's an issue that's not going to go away. We are at a competitive disadvantage when it comes to the attraction and retention of top talent. not just in municipalities like Scottsdale, but from a statewide perspective. We are losing 30% of our college graduates. They are graduating from fantastic institutions here in Arizona, and then they are leaving the state in large part because they don't see us as a state that treats people fairly. You know, our number one export is tourism, and Scottsdale losing an $800,000 contract in November of last year simply because of where Scottsdale and where the state is when it comes to LGBT, you know, consumers and citizens is a harsh reminder of the fact that when you don't choose to treat people fairly, it has economic consequences. So we absolutely hope that the state does step in and moves forward with the opportunity to update our laws and to treat everyone who lives and works and plays in this fantastic state fairly.
Is there any merit to the fact that these small business owners want to be able to have control over who they can serve?
So, you know, 19 states have adopted fully inclusive statewide protections, and there are over 200 municipalities throughout this nation, including Tucson, Phoenix, Tempe, Flagstaff, and Sedona, who have done the right thing and adopted LGBT inclusive ordinances. The reality is, if you're open for business, you should be open for business to everyone. And I don't think it makes good sense, nor would it be wise to try and move forward with a ordinance that chooses to discriminate against people. I think it sends a really bad message.
Angela Huey is with One Community Arizona. She's been working to try and get anti-discrimination laws in effect around the state. Angela, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
And that's KJZZ's Phil Latzman.
There's been a lot of focus on private prisons recently. Here in Arizona, they've been the site of riots and escapes and come under fire for unsafe conditions. Last week, the Department of Justice announced it plans to end the use of privately run prison facilities. At the same time, high prison populations have forced the issue of sentencing reform. But as these policies shift, so are the strategies of the companies like CCA and GEO behind private prisons. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins joins me. And Jimmy, what are these companies doing to follow current trends in criminal justice?
Well, Steve, as you said, high prison populations around the country have forced states to look at what we call alternatives to incarceration, things like probation, home detention, monitoring systems, anything that can be done to keep lower-level offenders out of jails and prisons because, you know, incarcerating people is such a huge cost.
So it's probably cheaper to keep an ankle monitor on someone than to keep them in jail while they're waiting on a court date.
Yeah, exactly. These alternatives to incarceration often include treatment programs as well. Carla Barrett is an assistant professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She says the programs can take many forms.
Probably the one that most people might be most familiar with is the idea of a drug court, that rather than being sent to prison, someone who has a drug addiction problem is mandated through the courts to treatment, and then through treatment gets better, gets released back into the community, and goes on to not offend and also not have to be incarcerated.
Barrett says there's an increase in the use of alternatives to incarceration programs for felony offenders as well.
They're often much more extensive, that involve court monitoring, where you check in with the judge every week or every month. You attend sometimes all-day programming, all-week programming to really try and deal with whatever the issues are. They often involve psychological counseling, anger management, job readiness, all of those kinds of things. And some of them run 3 months, 6 months, a year even in some cases. And the whole point is if you go through this program and are successful in this program, that then the sentence of incarceration will be rescinded.
These programs are run by courts, but often the treatment they prescribe is run by outside groups. In many cases, these are nonprofits. But now, as detailed in a report out today from the American Friends Service Committee, the for-profit companies are entering the field as well. Caroline Isaacs is the author of the report.
What we're seeing is essentially rebranding of these corporations to now be providing rehabilitative services or treatment or mental health. And there's been this move on the part of both Corrections Corporation of America and GEO to both buy up some of those fish in the reentry world, companies that run halfway houses or day reporting centers, Companies that make surveillance technology, like GPS ankle bracelet monitors for people on home arrest, and then start marketing that back to the very same governments to say, alternatives to incarceration is swell too. We can do that.
For example, Steve, back in 2013, CCA bought a company called Correctional Alternatives Incorporated, and they focus on running community corrections programs like work release facilities. It's one of these places where you go to work during the day, and then you surrender yourself each night to confinement in a facility.
Jimmy, even if it's run by a private group, isn't that still better than sending people to jail? And I mean, for them and for the cost to society.
Isaac's group supports the use of alternatives to incarceration, but she says the catch is when you turn the programming over to a private company.
Once again, when you insert the profit motive into this equation, then your decisions are going to be based more on the pursuit of profit than on the pursuit of rehabilitation. So just as some of the complaints and criticisms that we have of for-profit incarceration are that rehabilitation is actually bad for your bottom line. You want people to come back. So there's no incentive to actually do the correcting in your correction system. The concern with these other kinds of community corrections facilities or mental health treatment centers is similar, that there's no way for people to get out of your treatment, that it's going to be very difficult if the entity determining whether or not you are rehabilitated is the one that makes a profit off of your being in that program. That's some questionable motivation in terms of saying, you know what, you can go home now.
And Steve, Isaac says more and more people are entering into these programs and they're staying under supervision for longer periods of time. So, you know, like with everything else, Carla Barrett from John Jay says you got to make sure somebody's watching the shop.
I think oversight's always a key. One of the concerns we've had in New York is that you have a number of different groups running these different alternative incarceration programs. And then the question becomes, are they all doing the right thing? Are they doing it to the same level? And is there, in fact, enough government oversight of them? And that's, I think, a constant question. So is it better if all of these are run through actual government agencies? I'm not sure, but I don't know that there's often enough sort of quality control oversight to make sure that the programs are providing exactly the resources and also the outcomes that they state that they are.
So who is in charge of the oversight of these programs, Jimmy?
Well, private prison contracts are monitored by the Department of Corrections Contract Beds Bureau, but alternative to incarceration programs oversight really varies depending upon the government entity that signed the deal.
And that's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Thanks, Jim.
My pleasure, Steve.
Activists on both sides of the political aisle have been very open with their concerns about voting. Some are worried about voter suppression, while others say illegal voting is taking place. The News 21 program at the Cronkite School of Journalism at ASU sent students to 31 states for their project Voting Wars to explore the deeper issues. Jackie Petchel, News 21's executive editor, and student reporter Emily Mahoney join me. Jackie, first, why did your team choose to explore voting?
Since the Shelby County decision in 2013, which essentially did away with certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act, most significantly that states and jurisdictions had to get clearance to make dramatic changes to voting so that those, whatever changes they were going to make, would not affect primarily, you know, those who were most easily disenfranchised. For example, in the South, that would have been predominantly African Americans. So with the Shelby County decision, you know, overturned, now we're looking at what are states going to have to do to sort of both rectify and or make it easier and without putting restrictions in place for primarily minority voters to vote. And so that was our goal. You know, what is the state of voting in America? How significant is fraud? Who is most disenfranchised?
Can you give us an idea of what some of the conclusions were? What did some of your journalists find out?
We reviewed five key states this year as well and found that there were very few incidents of voter impersonation that would have been prevented by the most prevalent rule in place right now, which are voter IDs. But I think that what we found is clearly that people who have less access to transportation, live in remote communities, or live in very poor urban communities, were less likely to be able to either get to or find the resources to get a voter ID, which could potentially disenfranchise them from the vote. And most of those people, depending on where you live, were African Americans. We traveled the Deep South. We sent a team of at least six reporters at different times to Georgia and Alabama, and we were in Texas and Virginia, and we looked at how, in particular, the places where there was a significant civil rights history, how people were impacted. And the conclusion, of course, from those who advocate better access for African Americans was that they were more significantly disenfranchised, and the opinion from those who have put the rules in place was that they can access the vote if they really want to.
And Emily, where does Cincinnati fit in on all this? What sort of reporting, what sort of folks did you talk to?
Sure. Well, Ohio is a very interesting place when it comes to the voting rights debate because Ohio is one of the biggest swing states in the presidential election. So obviously it has a lot of national significance whenever you're talking about presidential election season. And when we traveled to Cincinnati, we saw some of the same themes within the lower income African American neighborhoods that the other teams found when they traveled to the Deep South. And that is a lot of people in these kind of communities feel that the civil rights movement is not over. And that's kind of a theme that a lot of us found in our reporting that quite frankly surprised me. The civil rights movement, obviously, you can't really talk about voting rights without talking about the civil rights movement. And people in these communities that are predominantly African American feel that it did not end in 1965 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and it certainly isn't over today. Ohio is embroiled right now in a lot of lawsuits over different removals of voters from the voter registration rolls, over eliminating same-day registration and some early voting days and some other things as well. And so when you talk about Ohio, you're really talking about a place where a lot of different themes of the whole voting rights debate play out.
Did you find that there was fear among some that their votes would not be counted, or that if they were trying to get to the ballot box, they would somehow be prevented or delayed from that?
Well, in Cincinnati, the thing that struck me most that we found pretty predominantly was a lot of feelings of disillusionment that kind of occurred before people even started thinking about going to the polls. And I think that in itself can be looked at a form of disenfranchisement, just because people in these lower income communities felt like their vote didn't matter. Whether or not they voted or not, it didn't make a difference because a lot of them had voted for President Barack Obama in 2008 and hadn't really seen a lot of change in their communities. And so they felt that if Obama couldn't do it, here's this man who looks like us, who made promises about improving areas like this. If he couldn't do it, then no one can.
Emily Mahoney is a student reporter who took part in News 21's journalism project Voting Wars. I also spoke with Jackie Petchel, News 21's executive editor. The National Park Service marks its 100th anniversary today, and Arizona's ties to the NPS are deep. That's in large part due to the Grand Canyon, the emotional reactions it generates, and the thousands of tourists who go there every year. But there's an even broader relationship, and one that isn't only about hikes and beautiful views. To dig in deeper and go off the trail a bit, I'm joined by Arizona Highways Editor-in-Chief Robert Steeve. Robert, how strong is Arizona's bond with the National Park Service?
Well, you know, Arizona's, you know, one of the states that has probably more national parks than anywhere in the country, and it's really part of our identity. I certainly, you know, see that as editor of Arizona Highways, and anybody who has driven through our state or actually visited one of the parks understands the great diversity that we have here in Arizona. But in all, there's, you know, 22 different Park Service sites in Arizona, and it's a little confusing because there are some national parks and monuments and things that are managed by the Bureau of Land Management, but in Arizona we have 22 that are administered by the National Park Service.
How has the importance of national parks in Arizona evolved over the years? Have people become more enlightened as far as that's concerned? Has that made the impact even greater?
How it's evolved is kind of interesting because 50 years ago, we also featured the National Park Service in our magazine and celebrated the 50th anniversary. And we have a few more parks in Arizona than we did back then, but it's actually fascinating to see how much was already in place even 50 years ago in our state. And since then, of course, you know, the traffic and the visitation numbers have gone up significantly, but those parks that were beautiful 50 years ago are still beautiful today.
Let's think back to the major government shutdown. And I believe that the average citizen was maybe concerned about certain government workers getting furloughed and some of the issues about that. But it seemed like almost everyone was emotional and passionate about, let me get into my national park. What are you doing to me? We've got to reopen the Grand Canyon. What does that say to you?
Well, I think it tells me that people care about our parks. And, you know, the Grand Canyon, for example, I mean, the visitation numbers have just soared up there over the last couple of years. And I think in part because parks are still an economical opportunity for folks. You know, in fact, for the next few days, the admission fees are being waived to celebrate the centennial of the Park Service. But even without that, you know, there are annual passes that are very economical that allows you unlimited access to any of the national parks. But, you know, in terms of bang for the buck, what you're getting, the national parks are, frankly, as good as it gets.
Is there an experience you can tell me about at Grand Canyon National Park that blew you away more than any other?
Well, I actually can, and I was up there about a year ago, and I won't go into all the details, but I ended up standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon with one of the 10 richest men in the world, just by coincidence, and he had never been to the canyon before, and I was thinking about how different our portfolios are, and yet that experience was exactly the same for him as it was for me. And I've been to the canyon more than 100 times, and every time I stand there, I have that same sense of awe. The light, the color, everything is different every time you go there. But I thought, you know, really spoke to just how grand the Grand Canyon is, because it doesn't really matter who you are. When you see that canyon for the first time, it you know, hate to use the cliche, but it really takes your breath away.
Robert Steeve is editor-in-chief of Arizona Highways Magazine. We've been talking about 100 years of the National Park Service and the impact on Arizona. Robert, great to catch up. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Even as parts of Arizona, especially the Valley, have become more urbanized, the state's identity is still closely tied to the national parks and the outdoors. ASU professor David Foster is a longtime observer of changing cultures and joins me. Professor, why do you think we so closely identify with the national parks?
The nature of the state, nature, not in the sense of character, but nature in the sense of the physical nature of the state, is so much related to the outdoors. This is one of the most beautiful states in the nation. And it's and with the weather that we have, it's inevitable that people think in terms of living outdoors, whether it's living outdoors in your patio or whether it's living outdoors going to the hundreds of parks that we have in the Phoenix metropolitan area, or whether it's going to the national forests, the national parks, and so on. And so there's just a tremendous, tremendous pull for people to get outside of the cocoon of their homes and to see the state.
There's been this kind of perception of Arizona over the last few decades as a place that is not as excited about big federal government programs and this sort of thing. So it almost strikes me as ironic a little bit that this place is so associated with the national parks, which is such a part of what we are at almost the unified United States level.
Well, it strikes me as fascinating because one of the distinctions we make in cultural studies is between the imaginary and between social fact. And individuals and societies have an imaginary, that is what they think is true, and then there's the social fact. We think that this is a state in which everybody is a rugged individualist and surviving on her or his own when this is one of the most federally subsidized states in the union. Several historians point out repeatedly this state would not exist without the federal dole.
How do you think Arizona's identity has changed as certain areas, particularly Phoenix and Tucson, especially Phoenix, have become so urbanized? And yet, it seems to me that in general, if people think of Arizona from outside Arizona, they think of Phoenix, perhaps, and then they think of the Grand Canyon, they think of the outdoors.
Unquestionably.
How do you think the identity has modified a little bit in relation to nature as we've had more urbanized areas?
Yes, what you say is absolutely certain, because as I travel around the country and travel in Latin America And my research is in urban culture. And so I talk a lot about Arizona, and people have no idea that Phoenix is the largest state capital and one of the six largest metropolitan areas in the country. They think of Arizona as mountains and canyons. This perception is very much there.
As we become perhaps closer together for many reasons, because we want to be closer to other people, because it's less expensive, more efficient, whatever it may be, how do you think that could potentially change our greater relationship with parks, with nature? Do you think we'll need them even more?
Yes, we'll need them even more. Yeah, because we've become denser because we need the services that density provides. Throughout most of its history, Phoenix really didn't need to be a city. There weren't that many services. Everything was still essentially out of the house or out of the something like a corner grocery store, for example. But you can't live in modern society without being involved in an immensely vast and complex network of services that only metropolitan areas can provide. The need to get away from that, the opportunity to get a perspective on that, that getting out into nature, so to speak, provides, is going to be more and more important.
Arizona State University professor David Foster.
It's been a good 100 years for the national parks, with millions of Americans enjoying their majestic beauty. This conservation and the NPS came from some of the work of the first environmentalists in the U.S., a Scotsman named John Muir. The BBC's Simon Watts has the story, talking about Arizona and the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service.
John Muir had been born in the Scottish town of Dunbar. His family were strict Protestants, but he found an escape in the natural world around him. Mary Colwell, author of John Muir, The Scotsman Who Saved America's Wild Places.
His early life was a combination of real freedom, because he had the sort of Scottish East Coast to explore. But then you have to contrast that with the fundamentalist faith of both his mother and his father. In a sense, his father was guilty of child abuse, really. He was quite violent. He hit the children a lot. He beat them if they couldn't recite the Bible. And I think nature provided that balm. Maybe it just wasn't as threatening as it was at home.
In 1849, the Muir family emigrated to a Christian community in the American state of Wisconsin. John rushed around exploring the uncharted forests surrounding his new home. But as a young man, he also became increasingly fascinated by engineering and even started inventing his own machines.
Nature and conservation didn't really exist at the time. So he went down this inventing path and was taken on. He was so good at it, he was taken on by all sorts of people. And one machine room that he was working in, he went to fix a machine, and a file that he was using hit a spinning cog, and it flirted out of his hand and went straight into his eye. And he went blind in that eye, and all the aqueous fluid came out of it. And then, in sympathy, he wrote, his other eye went blind too. Now, he did recover his sight, but it took weeks of lying in darkened rooms and not being able to move, and he went into deep despair. And after that, that was a life-changing moment, and he decided that from then on he was going to study the inventions of God and leave behind the inventions of man.
Now determined to see as much as he could of the world, John Muir walked 1,000 miles to the Gulf of Mexico. Then he took a boat to California and finally found himself at Yosemite.
Never before had I seen so glorious a landscape. These blessed mountains are so compactly filled with God's beauty. Drinking this champagne water is pure pleasure. So is breathing the living air.
It all seemed to come together in the Yosemite Valley, coalesce into what can only be described as a religious experience, and he knew that that was where his home was meant to be.
After settling down to farm fruit, Muir started writing very popular articles for magazines and newspapers across the US. His spiritual descriptions of nature were a stark contrast to the mood of America's gilded age. This was a period of huge economic growth, fueled by westward expansion and massive destruction of natural resources. When the sawmills started to overwhelm Yosemite itself, Muir's work turned angry.
Any fool can destroy trees. They cannot run away. And if they could, they would still be destroyed. and hunted down as long as fun or a dollar could be got out of their bark hides. It took more than 3,000 years to make some of the trees in these western woods. God has cared for these trees, saved them from drought, disease, avalanches, and 1,000 straining tempests and floods. But he cannot save them from fools. Only Uncle Sam can do that.
John Muir led calls for the federal government to protect places like Yosemite and turn them into national parks. He became the first president of the Sierra Club, America's largest environmental pressure group. And on one occasion, he even took President Theodore Roosevelt into the Yosemite for 3 days of camping and lobbying.
His voice was absolutely essential. By that stage, he was very well known. His writings were very sought after, and he looked fantastic. I mean, he looked like everybody's favourite grandfather with his great big beard and his strong Scottish accent.
Yosemite was made into a national park, and by the time John Muir died in 1914, several others had also been created. 2 years later, Congress set up the National Park Service to protect them and make them accessible to the American public.
And we've been enjoying them ever since. That story from the BBC's Simon Watts. It's been a good year for Pima County jobs-wise. Newly released numbers show the county added 15,000 new jobs between July of 2015 and July of this year. That's 4.2% growth. In Arizona, only Prescott had a higher growth rate. When you look at similarly sized metro areas nationwide, only Ogden and Provo, Utah had faster growth than Pima County. Joining me to talk about what's led to that is Pima County Administrator Chuck Huckleberry. And Chuck, first off, what do you make of these job growth numbers for your county?
Well, it's really, I think, the result of a pretty concerted effort to grow the tax base in Pima County. We've been looking at and really actively advancing an economic development plan over the last about 18 months. And so we've seen some pretty good results from that plan. And so and we're still pushing, and there are a lot more prospects, what we call in the pipeline.
What are some of the specific things that Pima County has been trying to do and will continue to try to do to bring more jobs and more companies?
Well, first, it's really a partnership between Pima County and the Arizona Commerce Authority, as well as our economic development entity in Southern Arizona, the Sun Corridor, and as well as the City of Tucson. So all of these partners are actually working together to attract new employers, or in fact, to also entice our existing employment base to expand.
When you talk with employers, who do you find that you are typically competing against?
Well, we're competing against typically the surrounding states, and so I think it's incumbent upon the state leaders in Arizona to understand that we need to remain competitive. And many of the things that we are competitive in today, if we do not make investments, we will not be competitive tomorrow, and we'll begin to lose this edge that we have. And I think the most important is transportation investment. A lot of our logistics locations, home goods, the Target distribution center, the fulfillment center, they're all made because we're still competitive from a transportation cost perspective. But unless we begin investing in transportation systems, we're going to fall behind.
Do you find that there are firms that are deciding, okay, we want to come to Arizona, but do we want to go to the Valley? Do we want to go to Tucson and Pima County? Like, is that a conversation that happens?
It's a conversation that happens more often than you would think. Probably, you know, maybe one out of every four potential relocatees. You know, when it comes to transportation mobility, the Pima region wins over Maricopa, and I think it's because of size. And it's just something that goes back to that transportation-related issue.
How has Pima County been doing as far as recovering from the Great Recession before, you know, you started seeing these growth numbers? I mean, is this a continuation of a recovery? Is this sort of the first big bump that you've gotten as the recovery?
I think it's really the first big bump in the recovery for the Pima region. It's no secret that we lag behind the Phoenix Valley in recovery, and I think we were positioned to have this significant success you're seeing now. The key is to try and continue to sustain that, because I think there are several options that are being looked at by relocating firms and growing firms that would basically continue to sustain that very high growth rate in employment.
Yeah, you saw a more than 4% growth rate between July of last year and July of this year. In your mind, is that sustainable? Is that a realistic goal to continue to shoot for?
At this point, knowing what is being looked at as far as locatees in the Pima County region, yes, it's very sustainable. In fact, it may even be accelerated.
For how long do you think it would be sustainable?
It's going to be sustainable for at least the next 2 years.
And then after that, what do you think is a more realistic maybe number to keep at for a good period of time?
Well, typically, we always have been very happy with a 2% to 3% growth rate in employment. And so I think that's probably sustainable. And certainly we never want to see it go negative, but that happens during times of significant recession.
That's Pima County Administrator Chuck Huckleberry.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Ramon Saiz. I'm the solid waste uncontained bulk supervisor, and we're collecting bulk material and some green material that's out there as well. We usually run into household furniture, some household appliances. You name it, something unusual show up that we haven't seen before. We do get tubs and, you know, shower. We've seen a toilet out there. Actually, we've seen people throw complete whirlpools away. We have to call them back. If they can cut it into fourths, then we can collect it. For those that like being out in the elements, it's a good job.
That's Ramon Saiz collecting bulk trash for the city of Tempe. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or yes, just think we should be taken out with the trash, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
A Tucson-based company is getting some money from NASA to do research with stratospheric balloons. They basically float on top of the Earth's atmosphere in an environment that's close to what a spacecraft in orbit around the Earth would see. Tabor McCallum is the Chief Technology Officer for Worldview, and he joins me. So, Tabor, how much money are we talking about, and what kind of research will you be doing?
We're not disclosing precise amounts of the grants, but the grants are for, or the contracts really, are for flying payloads. One of them is actually our own payload that is for controlling the altitude of a balloon and helping us develop that technology. And the other is a space radiation experiment.
So what are you hoping to find out with that?
The radiation experiment is really testing a kind of sensor in the environment that the balloon takes it into. So the organization has done a lot of work in aircraft altitudes, is getting ready to go into deep space, and a balloon is a great way to test at an intermediate level. We're above the atmosphere for the most part, but we're not all the way into orbit. And for the altitude control system, being able to control the altitude of a balloon allows you to control where it goes by finding different steering winds, much the way a hot air balloon goes to different altitudes to go different directions.
Now, I think for a lot of people, myself included, when we think about balloons, we think about the hot air balloons that, you know, have pretty designs on the tops with the baskets that people ride in. What do these balloons that you'll be using actually look like?
They're very large balloons that are made out of polyethylene. The biggest balloons are the size of a football stadium. And depending on the altitude you're going to, they can be a bit smaller than that. The polyethylene is clear for the most part, so it's a big clear balloon with a stratocraft at the bottom that is essentially a small robotic spacecraft hanging from the bottom of the balloon.
Why is Tucson a good place to be doing this kind of work?
First off, Tucson has a great business community, and a county and city, and really in Arizona, very forward-thinking economic development program, so it attracts high-tech companies. Secondarily, Tucson is really great because we have the university here, University of Arizona, and Arizona State University which do a lot of work in space. And lastly, the environment here is great for doing flight operations a lot of the year and has good launch and landing locations for us.
So I have to ask, your company has obviously been the subject of some amount of controversy in Pima County and elsewhere. It's sort of at the center of a lawsuit from the Goldwater Institute over the gift clause of the state constitution. Does the outcome of that case impact this particular work at all?
Unfortunately, we're not named in the suit. So it doesn't look like, no matter the outcome, it will really affect us going forward. We will be in the facility and operating long before this is ever resolved.
Yeah, what's the timeline on this? I mean, how quickly do you think you can start doing the research, and how long would it take to collect and analyze the data once you have it?
So we're doing the research now and flying balloons now. We've been doing that for several years. What the facility gives us is an integrated facility to be able to manufacture better and larger balloons and really get up to a manufacturing rate that meets our needs for the customers that we're having a growing list of.
Tabor McCallum is the Chief Technology Officer at Worldview, based in Tucson. Tabor, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
As politics seem to become more and more divisive, fact-checking sites have become a mainstay in the news business. Now, just about every speech a politician makes will be put to the truth test, but that doesn't mean everyone will believe what the fact-checkers have to say.
That issue takes front and center in a new article from nonprofit journalism organization The Poynter Institute. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with the author, and she joins us now. And Lauren, why don't people believe fact-checkers? Like, isn't that kind of the whole point?
It is, but it's not that simple, of course. So I talked to Alexios Montzarlis with Poynter. He founded a political fact-checking site in Italy and now runs Poynter's international fact-checking network. And he looked at a study that found that whether or not you believe fact-checkers has a lot to do with whether or not you subscribe to partisan media sources.
Essentially, the more you consume partisan news, the less likely you are to believe what the experts have to say on a factual assertion, even if you actually do know what the experts have to say.
Right. That was the most interesting part, I think, is that people know what fact checkers say about an issue. They just don't even believe them.
Yeah. And this is, you know, part of a general critique within the media system that partisan news are funneling us into echo chambers where you only believe what your side wants to believe. And so this is the first kind of indication that may be the case.
So these fact-checking sites have been sort of a rising trend in the last several years. Does this kind of research mean that they're not really useful?
I wouldn't say that. We see that partisan news makes things worse. Conversely, one would imagine that a more balanced media diet would make things better, would make people more likely to understand and believe the conclusions of fact-checkers. And also, and this ties into research that had been done previously, when a partisan media outlet fact-checks, quote-unquote, its own side, readers are more likely to believe it and take that, even if it's against their own interest. So I guess the solution is to get more of the partisan media to fact check their own side.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us a little bit more about this idea that you bring up in the article, the post-fact era.
Yes. So this is has become a bit of a trope that between the candidacy of Donald Trump, who has sort of stunned fact checkers in continuously repeated claims that had been debunked earlier, and also across the pond in the United Kingdom, the Brexit campaign had also made some grossly inaccurate claims that it took back the day after the results. I do think it's a cliche, and I don't think it means very much that we are in a post-fact era. Politicians have an incentive to lie, and you can go back all the way to the ancient Greeks to find, at the time, philosophers, not media outlets, but complaining about what effect these lies have on the public. And one anecdote I like to bring up is Ronald Reagan had famously apologized for the Iran-Contra affair by saying, something along the lines of, I know in my heart and soul that this was true, even though the facts and the evidence show that it is not.
Right. So you're saying this is not only research that was done before Donald Trump's campaign and before Brexit, but this has been going on forever.
Yeah. I mean, deception is not a new mechanism. We have had it in politics. That doesn't mean we should give up to it. I wouldn't be in my job and I wouldn't be advocating for more fact-checking if I thought that was the case. I just think we are setting ourselves up to failure if we think that every single fact-check will change every single person's mind. And honestly, I wouldn't necessarily want that to be the case either. On every matter, there will be some people whose minds won't be changed, but that's okay.
Do you think a lot of this stems from distrust in the media?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that are happening. The proliferation of news outlets and the fact that we get a lot of our information from our friends rather than necessarily from fact-checked sources. The low trust in media, so that even when there are fact-checks with clear sources, people question the motivation. Even a distrust in academics and experts in general are for sure a trend that's eating away at our capacity to reach the truth. But, you know, these are challenges. They doesn't mean they can't be overtaken.
All right. Well, Alexios Montzarlis with Poynter, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.